Ross, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Repeat after me. It's all about food. Because why? We know why. It is all about food. Everything that's connected to everything we do on this planet is connected to the food that we eat, our health, and the other animals on this planet that we share our home with, and the health of the planet, too. It's related to the food that we see on our plate. It's September 11th, 2012 today, and I just want to take a brief moment. I'm here in Manhattan, and it's a beautiful sunny day today, but there is some heavy, sad energy today in memory of what happened to us 11 years ago, and we can't forget that, but there are so many things that we have to keep in our minds at all times, and just process that with everything we do. Are we doing what we believe in? Are we supporting what we believe in? There are so many things that are out of our control. And, you know, we may elect some of our politicians and others may get through that we don't agree with. But the thing that we can control is what we do in our everyday lives, what we eat, what we buy, what we do, and the people we share our lives with, telling them that we support them and we love them. And just put all that love out there. I think it'll make a tremendous difference. And if there are things that are really annoying you, write letters to your politicians. Just do everything you possibly can. It matters. That's underlined. It matters. Right. Okay. It's all about food. And today, guess what? We're talking about food, my favorite subject. And I have a very special guest here today. I have Talia Furman. Now, Talia Furman. Oh, gosh. I'm looking for... I'm not prepared. I'm looking for the little bio that I had for you, and I don't have it with me. So we're just going to proceed.
You can help
you out, Karen. Tell me about you. Well, the thing that I want to say is there are a number of people in this alternative food movement that are like creating little, maybe a mini dynasties in a way. You know, we have John Robbins and Ocean Robbins, his son, and there's T. Colin Campbell, and his son is becoming a doctor
Absolutely.
Now. And Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn has his son, Rip Esselstyn, who's written the Engine 2 diet. We have Frances Moore LePay and Anna LePay following in her footsteps, and now we have Talia Furman, who is the daughter of my favorite doctor, Dr. Joel Furman. And you recently graduated from Cornell University.
I did. I now have my bachelor's degree in nutritional sciences. And you're absolutely right. When you're brought up in a household where you're taught what you are is what you eat, you can't help but want to go into this field. I grew up in my father's medical office when he was seeing diabetic patients and patients who had cancer and autoimmune diseases that they, you know, the patients believed were incurable. Right. And my dad would cure them. And it's just a miracle to see yourself struggling with your health, you know, can't get out of bed, you know, in the morning, or get migraines, whatever your health problem is, to have it disappear. And that joy in helping people is something so gratifying. I don't think there's anything more powerful than that. And if you're growing up in that environment, while you're also enjoying the food that you're eating, how could you not want to go into that career field? That is the question.
Yeah, well, I love everything that you're saying. Now, there are some kids that grow up and they tend to rebel against their parents. Now, did you ever feel that rebellion at all, or you just were on the path from day one?
110% there was rebellion involved. I'm a 25-year-old woman right now speaking from my gratitude from growing up, and this is where I am at this point. But, you know, elementary school, middle school, buying a chocolate chip cookie in seventh grade was the equivalent of doing drugs
or smoking
pot. It was, I had a little stash of candy under my bed. I went through that phase for sure, and I think that's natural as well. But in my case, by the time I was in eighth grade, I had committed to my dad's way of eating. And eighth grade is young. That's about 13
right.
years old. And you did not want to be my friend at that age, because if you were eating a donut, I'd say, you know, I'm not so sure you want to be eating that donut with all that partially hydrogenated oil and saturated fat. So I also went through the, you know, overstepping my grounds, where I just wanted all my friends to be on the lifestyle that I was on. And so I went through phases, but then I also learned that it's important to only, you know, give people advice when they ask for it. And
that's right.
You want to educate people, but you want to make people feel comfortable too.
What I like to say is you want to look good and you want to feel good, and you can do that on this great diet so that people will come to you and say, what is it? I mean, you're glowing. You always have energy. What are you doing?
We literally are what we eat. It's incredible. If we're, you know, eating kale and other green vegetables and drinking the green drinks, you can literally see a brightness in our face. So you know when somebody's eating healthily, and you know when somebody's eating the standard American diet, and breakouts, you look paler, you don't have that glow. It's remarkable. And it's a sign of health when you do.
Okay, so I just want to hear more about the rebellion a little bit, because this is a thing a lot of parents go through with young kids, and a lot of them give in. They just give in to the pressure. Media marketing companies know this, and they cater a lot to children, to brainwash children and make them want the toy, make them want the colorful, whatever it is, the sugary thing. And the parents give in because they can't handle the whining. So you started school, I imagine, kindergarten or whatever, and you must have been exposed from an early age to junk.
It's all about a balancing act. At home, my mom only had healthy food. There was no cookies, obviously. Mm-hmm. But outside of the home, she's not around when I'm in school, lunch hour. So I would eat whatever I wanted. And so all she could do was teach me about nutrition, and then I'm left on my own. Mm-hmm. And she basically treated me like an adult, and she respected me. And I think that's the most important thing you can do if you're a mother for your child, is you teach them the proper foods to eat, and you make them natural, wonderful, healthy foods at home that they like. And then outside the home, you leave it up to them to make the right choices. And my mother also knew that I liked, you know, pizza at school lunches. So maybe, you know, every other Friday when they have their special, you know, pizza that come in from Domino's, what have you, she wouldn't forbid me from having it. She wanted me to, you know, be like all the other kids. There's, you know, there's a right and a wrong, and I think that you can overdo it as well. So I'm so grateful for my parents for, you know, not being so overly fanatical that I rebelled even more.
That's good. And your siblings have gone through similar paths as you?
I would say so. Some earlier, some later. It's different from everyone. But I have two younger sisters. One is a freshman in college and the other is a senior in college. And we all love the way we eat now. We all just couldn't be more thankful. So it worked out in the end.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, so now you go to college and you're studying nutrition. And a lot of interesting people have come out of Cornell University. So what did you think of the program?
There's so much benefit from going to Cornell. You learn not just about nutrition, but also how food is processed in the body, what happens when you take a vitamin pill, how many people are on food stamps. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot about the psychology of what we eat, more than I did about what we should be eating. I'd say 3 out of the 4 years were spent taking chemistry classes, working my way up in microbiology and calculus. And a lot of it is a weeding out process. It is Cornell University, a tough school, and a lot of the people in my major were going into medicine. So I have to say I enjoyed it, and it taught me work ethic. But as far as what do we eat in our everyday lives to prevent diseases, that wasn't what it was about at all. It was actually very conventional at the time. The food guide pyramid was instead of the MyPlate was still around. So we were taught the food guide pyramid. Cornell has a prominent animal sciences department, and they're a huge fan of dairy and ice cream. We have a famous ice cream bar. Not exactly healthy for you, right? So any professor that taught that dairy products were harmful, there was going to be backlash involved. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that the advice I was given about what to eat was accurate.
Right. Mm-hmm. Did you have any rebellious moments while you were in college with any of your professors?
It was tricky because I did want to get those A's.
Yeah.
So I sometimes would go to office hours and try to talk to them one-on-one about, what do they think about the China study? Have they heard of Dr. Campbell and his work? And that didn't get me far with a lot of my professors, honestly. Mm-hmm. And many of them were overweight. and had health problems of their own, which I find very ironic.
Yeah, well, anyone that you're learning about nutrition from, or someone you go to a doctor where you want medical care, if they don't look healthy, why would you want to listen to them?
It's all too often. Now, my dad says he didn't take one nutrition class when he was in medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that say about our country?
Well, it says a number of things, but I mean, I've heard that there's a little bit more nutrition in some schools being offered today than before, but I don't think it's a whole lot. And the other thing it says is that your father is a genius. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's learned so much and he knows so much about nutrition, and I wish, I just wish there were a lot more of him to go around.
Right. And those classes that are taught, I took a few of them in high school. They're government-based, and what's recommended by the government is, you know, where do they get the money from? It's from the meat and dairy industry. It's full of propaganda. It's not exactly what the science shows. There's money involved, obviously. So it's a step in the right direction when we're offering courses for adolescents. It's teaching them to think about what they're putting in their mouths, but it's not the right information that we need. And obviously, given, you know, that heart disease is the number one killer in America and that breast cancer rates are increasing, it's one of the most significant problems in this country, and it costs so much money that it's a huge investment to teach people about what they eat for their health reasons, but, you know, economically, quality of life, it's such a tragedy that my father's information isn't common knowledge.
Yep, it is a tragedy. It is a tragedy indeed. And like you said before, you can't just tell people this information. They have to want to hear it. So often, especially when I see people that are sick, and I'm not a doctor, I'm not a nutritionist, and I know that I have information that can save their lives, and yet, you know, they're so close to wanting to hear because their doctor didn't tell them that information. It really is tragic. What about the kids? What about the young adults that you were going to class with? Did many of them feel like you did? I mean, I'm sure you talked outside of class about health and nutrition. Were they on the same path as you or different?
It was definitely mixed. Most of them were taught nothing about nutrition, came from families where, you know, maybe they were an Italian family and made a lot of, you know, meat and, you know, pasta dishes, most of them came in with no knowledge about, you know, true nutrition. And so, you know, it was mind-blowing to see a lot of these friends, you know, taking Adderall to study late in the evening, pull all-nighters, go to the dining halls and eat hamburgers and french fries. And these were going to be the future dietitians of America. That was most of my classmates. Then I, you know, after years of going to school there, I sought out friends who had the same philosophy that I did, and I found them. And there was a handful. And I just, they're my best friends now. And they have, obviously, you know, they did this research on their own. Not everybody comes from a family where it's just handed to you on a silver platter. So I respect these friends like no other because they're so passionate about it. They read the books on their own. They're self-taught, and that's remarkable. And so they are out there, but I'd say 1 in 10 people in my class was a vegan, or my dad likes to say a nutritarian, where you eat for nutrients.
Right. Mm. Well, it's going to get better, but we have a long way to go. And you are a part of that getting better. Excuse me. Okay. So you write occasional posts for different blog sites, and you just wrote a post that I thought was pretty interesting on body odor. What motivated you to do that?
Well, I had just read the biography of Steve Jobs, and Steve Jobs was a vegan. And he also wasn't a fan of bathing because he believed that his vegan diet left his natural body odor a pleasant, more I guess, delightful smell than his fellow standard American diet eaters. So I was wondering if he was onto something there, because I've had roommates in college that ate, especially the guys, a lot of the steaks and the meats and then just processed white flour products and pastas and cereals. And one of these roommates was so memorable. He smelled so bad. I'd have to open the windows after he took a shower. And I knew that it had to do with his diet and what he was eating. Mm-hmm. And a lot of guys, even if they shower, I'm sorry, they still smell. And I've also interacted with people who eat a nutrient-rich diet, and they don't have that terrible body odor. So it also, in my own life, I was noticing a trend. And so I decided to look into it. And I did find a study that showed that women, when they smelled the body odor of men who were vegetarian for only 2 weeks, they put the men on either a vegetarian diet or a non-vegetarian diet, and the woman... 100% of the time preferred the odors of the vegetarian men. And this was the only study that I found done, but it was very remarkable.
It sounds like a very gross study, actually.
It does.
That women had to sniff the different pads of odors with men on them.
Right.
We have a call.
Excellent.
Oh, great. So I have a few things I want to talk about on that subject, but let's talk to John from New Jersey. Hi, welcome to It's All About Food, John.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I had a question. I'm a big fan of Dr. Thurman myself. I have several of his books and DVDs.
Yes, we love him.
Amazing.
Yes.
But I also delve into a lot of information on 100% raw vegan as well, not just like the majority of raw vegetables and then a little bit of cooked. So I was wondering if, the young Dr. Fuhrman there had a chance to delve into a lot of that information as well.
Absolutely. I know the answer to this question.
Great.
Easily. Some nutrients are absorbed more efficiently when they're cooked, and some more absorb more efficiently when they're raw. And oftentimes when people go on a raw food diet, they can't get enough calories unless they're eating a lot of nuts and seeds. And so you often eat, you might be eating a lot of raw green vegetables and other vegetables, which is great, but how are you going to get the rest of your calories? Because those green vegetables are so low in calories, it's just you can't live off of them. Versus a cooked diet in which you're eating beans, because beans are so important for long-term health. Those have to, most of the time, have to be eaten cooked. What about tomatoes, for example? They're one of those foods, when you cook them, the nutrient absorption is actually enhanced. If you look at tomato sauce, for example, it's a nice, rich red color, versus sometimes a raw tomato is a paler in color, and you see the rich color, that's a sign that it's higher in nutrients. So and mushrooms, for example, are actually toxic when they're eaten raw, but when you cook them, they promote cancer prevention. So my dad likes to say 50% of your vegetables should be cooked and 50% of them raw. Because if you cook green vegetables, you could eat more of them at one time. Kale, for example, you cook it, and you chop it up with a nice cashew cream sauce, and it's delicious, and there's nothing more nutritious than that. So it's, raw vegetables are fantastic, but ideally you'd want to supplement them with cooked foods as well. There's a lot of myths out there about the raw food diet.
Yeah. Just like every kind of diet, if you're choosing to eat meat or fish or vegetarian or vegan or raw, there are variations on each one of those diets, and some of them are healthier than others. And even on a raw food diet, some people eat entirely fruit. And, I know one or two people that look like they're doing okay, but I think for the most part, most people don't thrive on all fruit. And then others, like Talia was saying, need to add more fat to their food just to feel satisfied. So it may vary between people, but...
Right, and sometimes health problems don't show up years later.
Right.
So people eating a raw food diet with primarily fruits, they could be okay for a few years and then suddenly feel weak or have a nutrient deficiency. And my dad has often seen this not just with 100% raw eaters, but sometimes vegans who don't supplement properly or they're not on a nutrient-rich vegan diet. You have to be careful when you go on plans like these, because you could feel good in the moment, but not later.
Well, you just said something. A lot of times in magazines and news articles, even some science articles, when they talk about vegetarian and vegan diets, they always say you have to be careful when you're having a vegetarian or vegan diet. But the thing is, you need to be careful on just period. We're learning more about nutrition. We all need to pay attention because most people are sick and they're on a meat junk food based diet.
Education is power, and we have all of the resources to educate ourselves. I could have learned more about nutrition, proper nutrition, by going to my local Barnes and Nobles than I did from attending Cornell. Mm-hmm. Cornell was rigorous, and you know, you get your basic education, but the true science that we need, you can just pick up a book.
Speaking of going to Cornell, I mean, one of the things you really want is that piece of paper that says that you've graduated, because that's very important in today's world.
Absolutely.
Steve Jobs did not have that piece of paper.
That's right.
But he was really very smart. But I wanted to say one thing about him, and that is some people will say that he was on a vegan diet. You know, why did he die?
I've questioned that myself, and Dr. McDougall has a fantastic article that I read online that talks about this very subject. And it seems as though Steve was exposed to toxic chemicals working with computers at a very young point in his life. Obviously, we don't know all of the reasons why he developed cancer, but cancer is something that starts in the body and doesn't, when you're young, and doesn't manifest itself in a cancer diagnosis, let's say 30 or 40 years later. You know, it takes that one DNA, mistake, and then, you know, doesn't balloon into that tumor much later on. So the vegan diet might have helped him live longer. He might have died much younger with that cancer. Mm-hmm. So it could have only been helpful, not harmful. And, you know, who's to say what actually happened? But that's essentially what the McDougall article says.
Right. Well, we don't know, but there are some things that we do know. And certainly a anti-cancer, superfood, immune system boosting, nutrient-rich diet is going to help anyone. But there are so many other factors to our health and well-being. And a lot of it is emotional and certainly environmental. And something can get out of balance. And then you really need to step things up a notch. So with Steve, of course, I don't know about him, but we know he worked very hard. Maybe he wasn't focusing enough on his sleep and mental attitude. I mean, there was just so many different
factors.
There's
so many different factors, and you could be a healthful vegan or an unhealthful vegan. And there's, for example, there's something that many vegans overdo is isolated soy protein. Mm-hmm. This is the processed isolated protein from the soy product. So I'm not saying that edamame or eating tofu or soy milk is bad, but when you see on ingredient list isolated soy protein, it actually promotes cancer just as would other animal products. And this is something in, you know, processed vegan foods, or if you eat, you know, at a vegan restaurant, we don't know what Steve was eating, and he could have been, you know, eating processed foods.
We
don't
know.
Who's to say?
That's right. Okay, so we just have a few more minutes, and I want to know what you're going to do with the rest of your life.
Well, I couldn't be more passionate about my future career, obviously, just from speaking to me. But my long-term goal is to go to culinary school at the Natural Gourmet Institute, working to make healthy food taste delicious, and also to get my master's and eventually become a dietitian. So to become a chef and a dietitian. And currently, I'm working on a body image book, How Do We Love Ourselves on the Inside and the Outside. And that means, you know, what do we eat to get clear skin, as you were saying before? How do we prevent Alzheimer's and dementia in later years? How do we feel good every day while we're young? But also, you know, what does it mean to feel good about yourself on the inside? And so it tackles the psychology of feeling well, because you could be eating this way, you could be slim and fit, but if you're insecure, you know, that's another component altogether. So it's geared towards young women.
Well, young women need this message. Mm-hmm.
So that's my big project at the moment. But who knows what'll happen in the future. I like not to think too much. You know, you can work in the present, but you never know what'll happen.
So when you want to have something decadent, if it ever happens, or for a birthday, for example, what do you have for a treat?
It's funny you say that because my weakness is dark chocolate, so I definitely understand temptation.
but dark chocolate has some nutritional value.
Dark chocolate's great, and it's the other ingredients in the dark chocolate, like the sugar and maybe if it's made with dairy products and the high fat. But cocoa is quite healthy, and I use it in a lot of my recipes. I'm a huge fan of baking, and I use unconventional ingredients like actually it's beans instead of oil, and it gives the recipes a nice, wonderful moistness, and I promise you can't taste the beans at all, and I only use dates or bananas or figs or other fruits as sweeteners, and I make fantastic brownies and muffins with strawberries and blueberries and blackberries and all sorts of great treats that are pretty much guilt-free. Even my friends who know nothing about the way I eat love them.
Absolutely. Well, we definitely need more of that. Mm-hmm.
Eat to Live cookbook is coming out in a few months, and that has a few of those recipes that I just mentioned.
I was wondering when we were going to see an Eat to Live cookbook. So we have to mention that Eat to Live has been on the New York Times bestseller list now for about 55, 56 weeks, I think.
It's crazy.
Yeah, this is really inspiring that so many people are interested.
I couldn't be more thrilled. And my father now has a new PBS show on Super Immunity, his other book. And that I couldn't recommend that more. And for anyone that's read Eat to Live, Super Immunity is a fantastic addition. I read it when it came out, and I learned so much. So got to drink that elderberry juice when you're sick.
Elderberry juice. I've never tried that.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, we haven't talked. We have like, 30 seconds or something? I don't even know. A minute or so. Your health. Do you get colds? And what's your health like after growing on this nutritarian diet for so long?
I have so much energy every day, and I rarely get sick. But we can't avoid getting exposed to viruses, especially in the wintertime and obviously when you're living in dorms in college. Mm-hmm. So I would occasionally get sick maybe, once every few years. And I would recover faster than my friends would. But that's not to say that I never, ever get sick. So if you're eating well and you do get sick, we're all human. Mm-hmm. But you rebound faster because your immune system is stronger.
Well, sometimes those effects that happen to us is our body's way of purging something that doesn't belong.
That's a great point. And fevers are a sign of detoxification. So we don't want to take medications to reduce the fevers. We want to just ride it out naturally and drink, and eat lightly when we're sick.
Mm-hmm. And do you travel much?
I travel all the time.
Yeah. And what's the food like when you get to travel? How do you manage that?
It's not hard. I don't understand when people tell me, oh, I can't eat this way because I travel all the time or this or that. There's vegetables everywhere. If you go out to a restaurant and you tell them that you want, spinach or broccoli or whatever, without salt or oil, they can make it. Obviously, it's not going to taste as good as what you can make for yourself at home, mm-hmm. but you can find it. There's often make your own salads at fast food places now. I always bring snacks with me just in case. Lara bars are great or other, dried fruits and nuts. And I pack, fruits that, like apples and oranges and other mm-hmm. goodies. But it's not been hard for me at all. Once you educate yourself and you know what healthy foods are to eat, you just make it a lifestyle and you make it work for yourself.
I just thought of something amusing to me. I did a water fast about I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, and it was supervised by your dad. And so now whenever I don't see food at an event or something that I want to eat or I can eat, and, you know, people look like they're starving and they have to eat something, and I always say, well, I know I can go 3 weeks without food, so I don't have to eat here.
That's such a good point, because when you eat healthily, you don't go through withdrawal symptoms of the toxic meal that you just ate. And my dad calls it toxic hunger when, you know, maybe a few hours after you eat a hamburger or something and you feel nauseous or you get a migraine,
right,
and you have to eat again, and that makes the symptoms go away. But I agree. I could just last for, you know, all day without eating, and I get hungry, but it's a mouth and throat sensation, and, you know, it's a pleasant sensation, actually, and it makes food taste better when you do eat. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I don't have to immediately get food in my stomach.
Yeah, you're not crazy.
Mm-hmm. No.
No. Mm-hmm. We're not crazy. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food.
Talk to you, Tanya. This has
really been fun, and I can't wait to see what you're going to come out with next. Books and recipes and everything yummy and delicious.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. This has been a joy.
Okay,
quick break now, and then we're going to be back talking about artisan vegan cheese with Miyoko Shinner. We are back again. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. It's September 11th, 2012. And thank you for joining me today. I want to remind you, my website is responsibleeatingandliving.com. ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com. The acronym is REAL, because what I talk about is real food for real people. That means all of us. And we have lots of wonderful recipes and videos and all kinds of things. And all of my shows are archived up there at ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com. I hope you visit and visit often. We like to see you there. And send me emails, info@realmeals.org. I love to hear from you, I'm there for it. Questions, comments, anything you need. If I can help, I will. All right. This is too exciting, and I am just going to roll right into it. We're going to be talking about cheese. Say cheese. Vegan cheese. Everybody says when they want to give up dairy that they can't give up cheese. How many times have we heard this? Too many times. Well, here we go. We've got the solution, and it's right here in my hands. I can't wait to talk about it. Artisan vegan cheese, from everyday to gourmet. We are going to bring on Miyoko Shinner, who has been a vegetarian for more than 40 years and vegan for more than half of that time. She's the author of The New Now and Zen Epicure and Japanese Cooking, Contemporary and Traditional. Miyoko has been teaching, cooking, and writing about vegan foods for more than 30 years and lives in Northern California with her husband, children, dog, cats, and pet chickens. Welcome to It's All About Food again, Miyoko.
Hi, Karen. It's nice to be on the show again.
Yes, thank you. Well, what I'm looking forward to is just talking to you alone, because the last time the show was a little crowded when we were talking about the vegan mashup. And it was too many great voices all at once. Yeah. Okay, so you know how exciting this is that you've come up with this book. It's like everybody's screaming about it in your world.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. It really is. And, you know, in my kitchen, it continues to be exciting, because I'm always working on new recipes for new cheeses.
As you mentioned in the introduction, this is based on lots of things and work that other people have done. And, you know, we're evolving in so many ways as a species, and we're evolving with cheese making, which is something that's gone on for a long time. And why not evolve to using nuts and seeds in order to make cheese instead of animal excretions?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, why not?
Yeah.
And so I think, I hope you realize it now and in the future, but I really think this is groundbreaking. I think this is going to be the foundation of a lot of future products. I hope we see them sooner than later, but I think this will really move people forward in making all kinds of wonderful different vegan cheeses.
Well, you know, I certainly hope so, and that was my intent. I mean, you know, I've been asked by people, why don't you just make them and sell them? But I really want to be able to give people the tools to do it themselves in the in their own kitchens. And, you know, a lot of people can't even get the commercially available cheeses as they are right now. But one thing I want to point out about the cheeses in my book that are different from, you know, what might be commercially available in vegan cheeses is that my cheeses are all cultured. And you're absolutely right. I took a tip from a lot of different people and lots of different, you know, processes that are already out there. The Raw Foodists completely inspired me with their, you know, culturing nut-based cheeses. But then I just took it a few steps further. And instead of just making a basic cashew cheese, like, well, why couldn't I turn this into cheddar or Gruyere or, you know, or if I did this, if I tweaked it this way, I added this, or I cooked it, or I cultured it longer, or to get a dry, hard cheese, you know, what if I air-dried it just like a regular cheese? Because that's what you do with, you know, the harder cheeses, like Parmesans, they're all air-dried for months and months and months.
I really want to think that more people are going to find their kitchens. I know we've gotten so far away from most people making their own food on a regular basis in their kitchen, and there is a certain amount of movement back there with food shows and people wanting to save on the cost of eating out, lots of different reasons, and just wanting to get healthier. So I'm always saying, find your kitchens, folks. But other than making salads and soups, vegan cheese is another level away, and it doesn't look like it's really complicated, but it is a little time-consuming. It does require some organization and a place to store things while you're waiting for them to grow.
Yeah. Well, you know, okay, so in terms of time-consuming, you know, they're absolutely not instant cheeses, although there is a chapter for practically instant ones that you can make. So you just can't wait, you know, things that you can make in a day or in a few minutes. They are available. There's a chapter for that in my book. But there really isn't a lot of hands-on time for any of the cheeses. It's really just a matter of waiting, and that waiting can be anywhere from 24 hours to several weeks. And but the beauty of the cheeses is that they gain their sharpness from the culturing process, just like regular cheeses do. You know, a lot of the commercial cheeses or a lot of the recipes that were available for vegan cheeses before involve getting that tang or the sharpness by adding something like lemon juice or vinegar, and then it really doesn't taste sharp. It just tastes a little bit tangy. And so, you know, what I really wanted to do was to let nature take its own course. And so that's what you have to do. You know, sometimes, depending on the cheese, you know, you might have to wait a couple of days, or you might have to wait a few weeks, depending on the texture and the flavor and the degree of sharpness you want. And then again, a lot of these cheeses actually taste better after they've been in your refrigerator for several months. It's strange, but they continue to age in your refrigerator. So it's kind of fun. It's exciting, and it is definitely more work than, you know, just going out and getting a package of something. But I think you're right. There is a movement towards getting back into the kitchen. I know that I make so much more myself now than I did. You know, I have three kids, and they're all older now. But when they were little, I mean, I started buying. I remember the day I was shocked. I shocked myself when I went into the store and I bought a jar of marinara. I couldn't believe it because I'd never done that in my life. I'd always made everything from scratch, you know, bread, vegan mayonnaise, everything.
But you get tired.
I just got tired and worn down, you know, just like making food all the time to feed all these mouths. And and so now they're older, and I've got more time, and I'm sort of back in the kitchen now. You know, my husband grows vegetables, and so from the harvesting to making our own, you know, my own jams, breads, vegan mayonnaise, you know, even vegan butter now, cheese. Everything. Everything there's less packaging. You know, my daughter gets upset about it. It's like, why, you know, why do we have so much garbage? Look at all this packaging. And every time you go to the store, if you're not buying just, you know, produce from the farmer's market, there's all that packaging to deal with. So,
you know, I like to point out, most people do these things obviously for convenience, and they're overwhelmed and they have a lot of work to do.
Right.
But these things that
I
are
hear you.
These fast foods and these convenient foods, if you really look at what it took to get them to your home, there's nothing fast or convenient about them. There's a big price.
No, it just didn't happen in your home. That's all.
That's right.
Somewhere
else. I mean, there were factories and people and processing and energy and lots of stuff goes into it.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I find a calm in my kitchen when I'm doing all this stuff. It's sort of like meditation for me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I certainly didn't feel that way when my kids were little. So, you know, I sympathize with the, you know, the millions of women out there, men out there that are trying to raise a family and put
small
a decent
children.
Meal on the table. So,
small children, teenagers, they all take a lot of everything.
Yeah.
Rejuvelac. So
I'm
really curious about this. I can't wait. I just got this book, so I haven't made anything in it. But I've tried. I once went to the Ann Wigmore Institute in Puerto Rico, and I spoke on environment and things like that. And I got to taste some of the foods and things they were doing there. And then I came back home, and I thought, I'm going to make Rejuvelac. And I couldn't do it. I failed miserably. So I'm going to follow your instructions and make some with some brown rice, I think. But here's one of the questions I have. So what it says here is you put the grains in a 1-quart glass jar, add water to cover. I can do that. Place a double layer of cheesecloth over the mouth of the jar and secure with a rubber band. I can do that. I sprout stuff all the time. I do the same thing. Let the grains soak for 8 to 12 hours. Great. Drain. And here's the question. Add enough water to moisten the grains, but not so much that they were immersed in water. How much is that?
Well, it's really not an exact science. I've actually, you know, just so they look wet, and
so I rinse them and then I drain them, and then they look wet, but there's no real water in there.
No, there's water in there. To be quite honest, I've been very sloppy with my Rejuvelac making.
Well, sloppy's good if there's room for sloppiness.
It's turned out anyway.
Okay.
So, you know, I've made it with a little, like a half an inch of water above it, as well as, you know, just barely just surfacing, touching the surface of the grains. And the only difference that I've found is that different grains take longer or shorter.
Mm.
And, you know, I know that there's a commercially available Rejuvelac you can buy in many parts of the country, and I think they use wheat berries. And
right.
I do use that sometimes, but I've done it with brown rice, done it with quinoa. Rye berries apparently work very well. I've never done it with rye berries, but apparently that works really well. So just because I can't seem to get rye berries for some reason, I don't know why.
Okay.
So, but, you know, I've been kind of sloppy, and it generally works.
Right.
Honest,
okay.
So.
I don't know why I had a miserable time. I only tried it once or twice, and it's not working, and I gave up. Okay, but I'm going to try again.
The reason I use Rejuvelac as the probiotic in the recipes, and it's not. I actually also use non-dairy yogurt as a thing that gets the culturing going as well too. So there's some recipes that don't use Rejuvelac at all.
Mm-hmm.
If you go through the book.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I use that is because a lot of the raw food cheeses, the nut cheeses, will say to use a powder probiotic. And what I found is that a lot of the powder probiotics are actually not vegan because they're grown in a dairy base.
Right.
And two, they're really expensive.
You can
spend $25 for a tiny little bottle. And I want my book to be accessible to as many people as possible all over the world. And, you know, in many parts of the world, you can't get a bottle of probiotics.
You know, you can buy a probiotic and it can all be dead. That's another problem.
True. That's true. And I've also used probiotic bottles. You know, I've used them before, and sometimes they just don't work.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that, you know, if I have a recipe for Rejuvelac in there, and, you know, you can buy whole grains anywhere in the world. You can get some kind of whole grain, and you can sprout that and turn that into Rejuvelac. So genius.
I just love the concept, and I can't wait to do it because, well, this whole probiotic thing, it's important to have them. We need probiotics in our gut. The powders are expensive, and I like the idea of making it fresh. It's got to be bitter.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I have to admit, sometimes I need to get make a cheese and I don't have time to make the Rejuvelax. Mm-hmm. I go down to Whole Foods and I buy a bottle. Cause, mm-hmm. But I usually have some that's homemade sitting around, but, you know, I run out and stuff like that happens. So.
Right. And then the other thing about making yogurt, I've made soy yogurt before. The last few times I tried it, it didn't work out so well. And now I know that I need to, because it's always so thin. But the cashews you add to the soy milk.
Yeah, there's
that
a couple
helps.
Of ways of doing it. I actually have a video on YouTube. If you go there and Google my name, Miyoko Shinner, homemade yogurt, you can watch a video where I show you how to make it. But, you know, I came up with that little trick of adding the raw cashews to the soy milk to enrich in it. Because I find that the commercial soy milks, I'm sorry, the commercial non-dairy yogurts, like the soy yogurts, to be a little bland. And the only reason they're thick is that they thicken them with tapioca and some other stabilizers.
Yep.
So if you want to make a traditional homemade yogurt that's thick by itself, you can do it two ways. You can either boil down the soy milk for about 15 minutes so that it's reduced by about one-third. And then you can make a really nice, rich, creamy soy yogurt that way. Or you can just, you know, throw in a handful of cashews into a quart of soy milk and puree that, and then use that to make your yogurt.
I can't wait to get started.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, good. Well, I want you to get in your kitchen right now.
Oh,
get
no.
off the phone.
I am.
The radio. Get in your kitchen.
Well, I'm going to go to the store right after this and buy a few things that I need. And I promise I'm going to do those things. Okay. And then not only do you have cheeses in here, and so I found the basic routine is pretty similar here with your different recipes. Some of them have some really lovely flavors, and by culture them shorter or longer, you get different flavors. You use some oils to give some of your cheeses a more meltier feeling. You've got hard cheeses and just about anything you'd want to make. The cream cheeses look outstanding. And then,
well, the cream cheese is, you know, I know there's a lot of cream cheeses on the market, mm-hmm. but the one thing I can say about the commercial vegan cheeses is that the first ingredient in most of them is oil.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is sometimes soy protein or soy milk, and then it's just, you know, basically it's oil with maybe a little bit of some sort of protein and then stabilizers. And to me, that doesn't seem like a whole food.
Nope.
So I really like to have foods that, you know, I want to be eating mostly whole foods. And I'm not, you know, I'm not as pure as your last guest. you know, I do engage in what Chef AJ calls the evil trinity, salt, sugar, and oil on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I definitely choose what I eat sometimes with my taste buds. But for the most part, you know, 95% of the time, I do like to have whole foods, plant-based diet, not, you know, eating processed vegan foods. So,
well, I like
I try to stay away from the
I think we really need to go backwards as we're going forwards in time.
Yes.
And backwards in terms of using whole foods, getting all the chemicals out of our foods. You know, I have this crazy chemical engineering background, and yet I hate all of the chemical engineered foods that
right,
just shouldn't
right.
be. And I personally, in most of my foods, I avoid oil and salt, but then I like to have some toppings and things that and that's where some of the fat and the soy and the salt are, because it's just like a garnish. It's not the whole food is laden with oil and salt, and,
right.
And that's where this cheese is wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm with you. I don't cook with a lot of oil and salt either, generally speaking. But you know what I found with my cheeses is I tried to make them as oil-free as possible. But I could not get them to melt unless there was some oil in them. But the first ingredient isn't oil, it's something else, like mm-hmm. the soy yogurt. And then there is a little, you know, there's enough oil in there to get them to melt. But nutritionally, they still stack up much better than their dairy counterparts. Or their, you know, or the stuff you get at the store. But most of the other cheeses, you know, 90% of the cheeses in the book do not use oil at all. Because I've tried to avoid it, and they're based on relatively healthful ingredients.
I think it's wonderful. We, in this whole vegan movement, there are so many different voices promoting so many different things, and anyone that chooses to eat vegan, even if it's Coke and potato chips and French fries, shouldn't have to apologize for not wanting to eat animals. That's a beautiful thing, and everybody should be doing it. And for those of us who want to pursue a healthier lifestyle by eliminating all the artificial chemicals and ingredients to improve our health, that's just another great step. But I love the fact that we can have these cheeses, and they're made from wonderful ingredients. This is just a brilliant thing. I can't wait to get started. And then you've got some desserts going on here in the back, tiramisu, which looks fabulous.
Yeah, and that tiramisu recipe uses an egg white made out of flax. It's a flaxseed.
I saw that flaxseed meringue.
Yeah, and it whips up just like egg whites. It's just amazing. Now, you can't bake with it, but you can fold it into mousses and things and to lighten it up. You know, you can make like a chocolate mousse and make this egg white, this flaxseed egg white thing. And then it's just incredible when you whip it up. It looks just like egg whites. It's got the same texture. Fortunately, you can't bake with it, but it's great for folding into things to lighten it up.
And the amazing thing is flax seeds come with so many good things for you.
Yes, yes.
I don't know why more people aren't jumping on all of this faster. Okay, so you don't have any immediate plans on making any of these cheeses yourself? For sale, for manufacturing?
Oh, you know.
Who knows?
I've been in business before, as you know. But I am entertaining certain things, considering going into the restaurant business again.
Here's the thing,
that is something
for you.
I am entertaining.
I mean, I'm sure you've thought about all of this, but when you first came on the scene, and I will never forget it, I told you this the last time we spoke, but I remember the restaurant Now and Then. It was near Japantown, and then there was, right? It was around Japantown, San Francisco, somewhere around there?
Yeah, absolutely, it was.
And then I was so excited when I was flying on United to have the Now and Then cookie. The thing is, you were one of like our four persons, I don't want to say forefathers, but the timing, people weren't like ready yet, and now people
So
it must have been very painful for you in that time. We didn't have the internet, you didn't have all this access to marketing, and now the time is really ripe for vegan cheese by Miyoko.
Yes, it definitely, when I started, I was always constantly explaining to people why I didn't use dairy or eggs and why I didn't use sugar, because, when I had Now and Then, we didn't use any kind of sugar either. And I still don't. I typically use, natural sweeteners, I guess, that can be qualified as sugar by a lot of people, but, maple syrup and that sort of thing. So, the time is right now, and I am ready. I'm ready to take off. So, I'm hoping that this cheese thing goes somewhere. I love to teach. That's one of the things that is most important. That was the one thing about manufacturing that I really didn't like, was it was just sort of unilateral. I'm just putting food. I'm just, distributing food. But there was no...
Yeah, but people really want this. People really want vegan cheese. Now, I just was curious. Yeah. When you're growing things, bacteria, have you ever had any batches go bad, or are there some safety concerns that we need to keep in mind?
Yes, and that is something that's very, very important that I should state, is that this is not an exact science, and different temperatures, how clean the equipment are you're using, the ambient temperature of the room, the humidity, all of that comes into play in how your cheeses perform. And so, if you're working at, 90% humidity in 110 degree middle of summer, your cheeses are going to culture much faster, and they can go bad much faster as well, too. Mm. So there's things that you have to watch out for. It's not as simple as providing a recipe for, making a pasta sauce or something.
Right.
It's a little more complex.
Yes.
It's an art, and you really have to watch these things. And it would be wonderful if I went into manufacturing. I'd have to figure out some sort of, uniform, temperature that they would all be cultured in. I'd have to have something like a cave or something like that, whereas, you know, they'd be temperature controlled and all of that so that you can sort of predict the outcome of the product.
Yes.
But the fact is, you know, I give a range on how long you should culture these cheeses because it depends. I mean, even in my own kitchen, sometimes the sharp cheddar takes 48 hours and sometimes it takes 96 before it's ready.
Well, I know somebody's going to do it. I know some people are going to start doing it, and it's just a question of when, and we're all evolving now, and vegan cheeses are there. And so thank you. Thank you for getting the cheese ball rolling. Thank you, Miyoko, for joining me again on It's All About Food, and all the best to you with Artisan Vegan Cheeses. I can't wait to
dig
into it.
Thank you, Karen, for having me.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you've heard another episode of It's All About Food. Join me at responsibleeatingandliving.com, and have a very delicious week. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.